This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I remember. So I'm weird. I started talking and walking when I was still basically an infant, so I have a lot of memories.
She's actually underselling that. Started talking and walking before she was one.
Yeah, like 7 months and 9 months old. So
memories from when she was less than one.
I remember being very young, and for some reason, apparently, I thought you started a performance by saying, "Damn it, boys and girls, happy birthday." So I would stand up on a chair and say, "Damn it, boys and girls, happy birthday," to my parents. And then, I don't know, sing. I would do Ethel Merman impersonations by the time I was like two. My parents would hum a theme song from a TV show and I'd be able to name it. Like, I was very into entertainment from a very young age. And both of my parents were actors when they met in college. And so I think that rubbed off on me. And then I started dancing when I was four. I did ballet for 14 years. And then I was in church choir and I was a soloist and I was so loud that they wouldn't let me use the microphone. And then I think I did my first play when I was like nine, and it was at the town library in Trumbull, Connecticut, and we had to write our own play. So I always said to Nick, "Oh, I wasn't a writer. I never wrote really until I met you," but that's not true. I wrote my first line of dialogue when I was probably younger than nine. I think I was like six or seven, and I was playing Mother Earth, and the line was, "Quiet, my children." I remember.
You wrote that line.
I wrote that line.
Quiet, my children.
Quiet, so yes, I definitely was a performer from birth, essentially.
I had two sisters I know from when I was young. And my brother's birthday. My brother's older than me, and at his birthday party with I know a whole bunch of other 5-year-olds. Me, his 2-year-old brother, stood up and sang a solo of Happy Birthday to him. So I know about that one. And then I know another occasion when my parents, I had supposedly gone to bed, and my parents were having some dinner party downstairs, and I dressed up as Charlie Chaplin, came downstairs, walked once around the dining table, twiddling some makeshift stick that I had.
Like
the Charlie Chaplin cane. I walked once around the table and left. So I didn't even wait for any feedback. I just had the laughter as I was going back upstairs to bed. So apparently I was showing up even then.
Well, you also would do, I thought of something else. I was totally the annoying cousin who would make everyone put on a show. And I would like dress them up in my leotards. I had a zebra leotard, so we did Lion King. Mm-hmm. And I was also very bossy, so I should have known then that I was also going direct and produce. I just hadn't realized it. But you also, wouldn't you do the dance from
My goodness,
Mary Poppins?
Yeah. There was a, I don't know, it was Easter holiday or something like that. We had it back in the UK when I watched Mary Poppins every single day. I mean, I think multiple times a day. at home during this vacation, and I completely go obsessed by Bert, and so I would do the whole kicking his up, step in time, that one, yeah, went over the rooftop, step in time, all that stuff, and I was jumping up and down all over the sofas. You know, there were enough sofas in this room that I could jump up onto them and go along them like they were the chimney top. So yes, I did a whole lot of that. That was for no one. That was just for my
They're both very shy and retiring children, as you can tell.
Yes, yes. I like the Charlie Chaplin at the dinner party and then just leaving immediately. I feel like that's sort of the artsiest. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, leaving them wanting more, getting that from a very early age.
Proving that you don't need their applause. You're just there to entertain them.
This is just for my benefit. I just wanted to show off Charlie Chaplin.
Just incidental that you happen to be here.
I'd normally come into the dining room at this time of night and do this. What a surprise, you're here.
You're lucky that you get to experience this in this moment.
Yes.
And it's over.
A rare gift. And that's it. Never to be performed again.
Also, I know in the film world, not needing a microphone is probably trouble for you, but believe me, that's like high praise for them to say, no, you don't need a microphone. I'm like, yeah, you don't.
That's right. I knew how to project from a young age. And I came up in theater, so
yeah.
It definitely served me very well.
Her singing voice is absolutely magnificent.
Oh,
so if she's in church and singing, inevitably all the members of the congregation who are sitting in front of her turn around. And, start with it, turning around and going, who is this angel that's singing? And then by the end, there's always somebody that comes up and says, I have to say, you have this beautiful singing voice. And then they look at me, and then they don't say anything. And then they leave. Sarah's voice is strong, powerful, and beautiful.
Thanks.
And mine is also a voice.
Well, it also made me very unpopular when I was... I started homeschooling when I was in fifth grade, but until then I was in a Catholic school, and my music teacher really loved me because I would come up and sing. She would always want people to come and sing, and nobody would ever volunteer, and I would always volunteer, so all the kids hated me because I would just, belt out Joni Mitchell tunes during our music class. Completely unembarrassed, completely unencumbered, and I was not popular at all, not even a little bit.
Were you confident all the time, though? Did that confidence carry you through?
It's such a weird thing, because I think I am weirdly confident if I know the thing that I'm being confident about is right and just and good. I think expression and entertainment and art is really valid, and I always valued it as a kid. So I thought I was just sharing this gift that God had given me and that I had inherited from my parents, and everybody else was too shy, so I'll do it. That's fine. Uh-huh. But it was never about I'm amazing. I don't have that kind of confidence.
Yeah. But confidence doesn't have to be cockiness, It doesn't have to be I'm the best. By the way, I don't know if you guys heard, I'm amazing. Write it down. Tweet it immediately. Confidence was my dad's number one lesson. He was always harping on that all the time. He was be confident. Confidence will get you through anything. If you are confident, people will give you the world. Confidence will help you no matter what's going on. And I was just no problem. And it never occurred to me until years later how much it did help. I just thought, I just thought I was me. So I was when I want something, I'm like, hi, I would like that. And when people are rude to me, I'm like, don't be rude to me. And it's fine. I don't know what the problem is. Turns out, it doesn't work that way for everyone.
I wanted to just be myself and stand up for what was right. And I really took that to heart. But in my adult years, I sort of had to relearn that, I think, a little bit. And one of my favorite quotes is, God grant me the confidence of a mediocre white man. and I try to remind myself of that. If I see a posting for someone looking for a woman who does this thing and that thing, and I will recommend other women that I know, but I'll also be like, you know what? I'm going to recommend myself because I'm good at those things too. And I sort of had to relearn how to do that as an adult, because the world will try to stamp that confidence out of you. I think specifically as a woman, but in general.
Yeah. I think the whole world's trying to do that for sure. As you get older, you know more, but then you're also so many more things could hurt me. And that's my voice, not yours. And,
it's a relatable voice.
Thanks. But you know what I mean? It's definitely something that happens as you get older. You get a little bit more nervous because you've definitely witnessed terrible things happening. And you're like, yeah, that's not just a TV show. That's real life.
I think you do reach a point, and I think it's a different point for everybody, where you just stop giving AF, and you're like, you know what? I don't care if people are going to not like what I have to say or think I'm dumb or whatever. Life is too short to not be myself. or talk about what I think is important or do what I love doing. And I think I've reached that point. I reached that point several years ago.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, I find, is that those of us who are performers, you know, we can be a myriad of, you know, we can be confident, we can be, have high self-esteem, we can think that we can be cocky, or we can be depressed and not believe in ourselves, but still when they go out on, like, how many people have you known throughout your life where, like, you talk to them off stage and they're like, oh man, I don't know what's going on with Leonard. I mean, he seems terrible. And then he goes up on stage and you're like, oh my God, he's amazing. Like, I don't know. Things do not connect.
It's opposite sides of the same coin, I think. You know, I will have an hour in which one moment I'm feeling top of the world, super confident, everything's great, and then I'm crying going, why am I doing this? What's wrong with me? What is the hardest thing in the world? And I think for me, being on stage and playing characters has always been an opportunity to, I don't know, be in front of people in a way where I don't have to worry about them judging me. Because obviously I'm bringing myself to everything I do, but they're not judging me. They're judging the character. It's not really me. So acting can serve as like a mask through which you actually get to express parts of yourself that you might otherwise be afraid to. And I think that's always been a really interesting part of it for me. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I don't know how I feel about that.
They're just judging you? Interesting.
I have no idea. So I don't think about that. Before we go on stage, so I'm very familiar before we do our monthly show of going, why do I do this? Like, what on earth possesses me to think that this is actually a worthwhile thing when I could just be at home right now? I could be, you know, watching the television. And here I am backstage in a theater. And then, of course, it starts and it's fun and it's
so fun.
And I feel, you know, it's just enjoyable sharing that with a bunch of people and then hanging out afterwards and going for tacos. And
yeah, that's our, we have a monthly show in Hollywood at Second City, and our tradition is that we go and get tacos with everybody who wants to after. So it's like, even if we really don't want to do the show, sometimes just knowing there will be tacos forward, at the end of it will get us through.
Our next one will be 12 angles.
Yeah, yeah.
Nick, when you're right before the show and you're, you know, in that moment of like, oh God, why do I do this? Is it more like, you know, fear of what's about to happen, or like, you know, a diffusing sort of feeling? Were you like confident a moment ago? Like, how does it work for you, the confidence to like make it happen?
I think I have a slightly pragmatic streak to me, which is that, well, this is happening. This is the thing that's happening right now, so I'm just going to do it. So I think that, I don't think that I have an issue in the sense of it being a confidence thing. I mean, much as I can get nervous and everything like that before doing the show, particularly if I don't think I know my lines well enough. I think that feeling beforehand is more like some part of what would be my adult brain kicking in and going, I don't know, really? Is this what you want to be spending your time doing?
But don't you think it's also the grind of it, though? Too, where it's like, it's effort. It's a lot of effort. You know, you put on this show and you don't know, there might be 7 people in the audience.
Yeah.
And you sometimes think, you know, you're pouring all this time and energy into this thing and you love it. You do it because you love it.
And it is
but
hard to get people to come out, isn't it?
It is. It's hard to get people to come see live comedy, live theater, unless you're, you know, a huge star or a Broadway show. And so it's a lot. It is a lot of effort. And we've been doing it for a concentrated period of time now. So occasionally it's just the burnout of like, all right, I know why we started doing it. I know what we love about it. But is there a point? Like, what's the end game here? Are we going to get to reach all of the goals that we have, and is doing this show on this night really something that we have to be doing right now? Yeah. But as Nick says, it's like the second it starts, the second the lights go up and you're on stage and you're connecting with the audience, all of that goes away. Because you're doing the thing you love and you're connecting.
Well, actually, I think there's something really good about having things like just in the calendar that force you to sort of get off your butt and things. Cause otherwise, life can pass by where you just didn't really ever get around to doing anything, and you know, it can really just kick-start your energy.
Yeah, And I think, I also think that, you know, both of us can beat up on ourselves about, oh, we're not doing enough, we're being lazy, we're not being productive enough. But I had a realization the other day that over the past 3, maybe 4 years, I have produced like 96 short films, and 93 of them have been for us.
That's insane.
So it's a lot. We've done a lot. We've achieved a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, your website says new comedy videos every week. I was going to ask you, what? Every week?
Every week.
That's a lot of weeks. That's a number of weeks. And you are now currently telling me that you do twice as many as once a week. 96.
Well,
this is over.
No, no. So this is over the period of years. And we started out doing every other week. And we did that for a long time. And that's already a really long time. And then in, what was it?
I must be in the middle
August?
Of August. Yeah, it was just after
July. It was July, August of 2018. Yeah. Facebook approached us and said, we're doing this pilot program for successful independent creators. We want to put you in it. And you'll get a little money and you'll get some boosting and some new information about your audience, but you have to upload a video every week and it has to be at least 3 minutes long. So since August of 2018, we have been uploading once a week, which is a lot. And we did reach a point where we got a little burnt out. Right. And so we started releasing live videos. And at first I was really nervous thinking that the audience was going to be disappointed or somehow it was going to be like a failing on our part because we have really high production value videos when we do them. But I think it's actually been really nice because most of our 70,000 fans don't get to come see our show live. So it's given us an opportunity to sort of restore our energy, get some new ideas, schedule in some more filming time, and also allow our audience to connect with our material in a different way.
Hmm. It's like you're doing stand-up now. You're trying out jokes on the in the videos, and then later you can put it in the live show.
Well, we, you know, there has been back and forth. We used to use the live show a lot to test out new material before we filmed it. It was a really good, like, testing ground, see if the jokes are landing. And in theory, that's what we do, in quotation marks, but we don't anymore. A lot of the time we're writing a sketch 12 hours before we film it, or it's a step that doesn't really work on stage, so we have to just trust that it's going to work on film, and I think we have a pretty good track record of it, so I don't know, it's just, it's a different experience. Even the same sketch filmed is a very different sketch live, and so
yeah,
it's kind of nice to watch that.
Yeah, I guess you're right, they are a different, it's a different animal, so trying one out to do the other is just, you know, it's kind of like we were talking about earlier where they wouldn't give you the mic to sing because you were just so darn good at projecting. I bet you on the first film you were in, they were like, a little quieter. Definitely that's what they said to me.
No, I'll pat myself in the back. I knew how to. I mean, I had really.
You're very quiet. Oh.
I started training professionally in New York when I was 18, and I went to the Atlantic Theater Company acting school, and I did on-camera and theater training there. So I learned from a very young age how to sort of, you know, they're different mediums, and you sort of use your instrument in different ways.
Yeah.
I learned it on the school that that they were distinct media, and
right.
And it seemed a bit weird and a bit scary to shift into film to start with. And I remember, I think actually it was when we first filmed our website. It was the first time that I remember looking at footage of myself and going, I did it suck.
Yeah.
And I think ever since then, I've tended to be okay to look at my footage and think, oh, this is actually okay. You know, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's so good, sometimes it's okay. It's never
terrible.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas I think some of my earlier stuff is actually probably going to go down to terrible.
I don't think it was terrible. I doubt that.
Oh, it speaks so well of your normalcy, guys. I'm so narcissistic. I like watch old things I was in. Like, I'm like, yeah, you're good. Look at that.
I love that. I think it's great. I also was thinking back to when I was doing theater. I actually, the bulk of my theater experience before I was in my late teens was I did Shakespeare with a homeschool Shakespeare group, but also I trained with this adult acting class at the American Shakespeare Festival Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which just burned down. It was very sad. But I had a really great director who allowed me to be very natural as an actor. on stage, which I think especially when you're young, you get a lot of people pushing you to be big and huge, and you lose the nuance. And also my choir director told me not to start getting professional voice lessons for singing until I was 17 or 18 because my voice was still developing. And I thought that was really excellent advice. And she said a lot of times when kids start taking singing lessons when they're little girls, they end up all sounding like Annie. And they sort of sound like cookie-cutter versions of, you know, what a musical theater singer is supposed to be. So I sort of avoided that hurdle. But when I started doing musical theater, I would get the note from the directors, not all of them. My director, Trevor Fanning, was not like this. But a lot of the directors would be like, you need to be bigger. This is musical theater. You really need to emote. And I always sort of rubbed up against that in the wrong way because I love musical theater. And I think there is so much nuance in it and so much humanity. And when I don't know, good musical theater, you have good actors who can also sing really well and oftentimes dance really well. And I think a lot of the time when you're younger and you're doing musical theater, it's like sing and dance really well. Who cares about the acting?
My old teeth and smile.
Yeah. So I always sort of rebelled against that a little bit. I really prefer grounded acting.
Well, we have the situation now because we put out all these videos and we don't edit them ourselves. We bring in people to edit them for us, but it's always done remotely. So they'll do a rough cut, and then we sit and we're watching the rough cut, and they're giving very, very detailed notes. And so we've spent a lot of time looking at ourselves and our performances. Mm-hmm. But it's very odd because we always think about ourselves in a very third-person way. And so, you know, is there a shot where he does this differently, or he gives a better reading, or, you know,
or he doesn't mess up the line.
Shave off a second here, and and cover up Nick's bluffs here and there. And of course, this is talking about ourselves, but we're sort of able, I think, from doing quite a good job of being super analytical of ourselves, but in a very self-destructive way.
Well, because much like musical theater, sketch comedy is a realm where a lot of people who are doing it are sort of performing in an almost tongue-in-cheek way and not very grounded. And I think the reason people have responded so well to us is because we are actors first, and we are committed, grounded actors first. Even if we're doing silly accents or big characters, you know, I think what makes things funny is if the people in the sketch or in the play or whatever it is are really invested and really committed, then the audience is committed, and then the comedy is bigger or the drama is bigger or whatever it is. It hits harder because it matters to the people who you're watching.
In
good musical theater, you've got the song actually tells the story, develops the character, moves things along, gets to know the person a bit better, and so it's much more grounded in the real person.
Well, the theory is supposed to be the music comes in because the emotion is so big that speech can't paint it anymore. It's so important that this song is the only way to express it. And you can only get there convincingly if the actor playing that part is really committed to what they're going through before the song happens.
Yeah, have you ever done musical improv?
Oh, yeah. Musical improv is the crack cocaine.
Yeah. It's like mixing both of these things that we're talking about, right? And I think you're totally right that most musical directors, and certainly in the high school realm, people have a tendency to kind of like brush off the talent of the kids. Like, I teach a kids comedy camp and they're in high school and I'm always like, okay, what do you want to do? What matters to you? Let's put this up on stage. Because most of the rest of the time, they're being handed roles or jokes from, oh my God, there was this one thing. They gave them this, like, these songs from this musical. The musical was written, it's got to have been in the 70s. Okay? None of them were alive in the 70s. And the jokes are making fun of things before the 70s. They're like, can you believe this? And I was like, okay, guys. I'd be like, I talked to my 20 kids and I'd be like, who knows who Carol Channing is? No one? Cool. Awesome. This is going to go so well, this joke that we've been handed. So, you know, I understand, like, in the world of musicals, not only are they, like, not giving kids the benefit, you know, maybe you were the best. I'm sure there was a lot of people who were, like, not great. So, you know, what are you going to do? But I love the idea of what you're just saying, which is that the person in the musical has to be having an emotional situation happen in their life such that they're like, there's no other way for me to express this other than to sing. And I remember when I took musical improv and like did that for a while, we were always talking about that. We were like, you just really have to get into the emotional place right away. And as a teen, I could see that being, be louder, have more emotion, as opposed to like, let's have a discussion about what's actually happening. And be like, I can see how you could get upset about that. Cool. Act upset about that. Like,
and to be fair, like, public education and arts programs in general are usually wildly underfunded, and these people are trying to pull a miracle out of nothing, out of thin air, with, like, pennies to their name. So I'm not hating on musical theater directors in high school. I'm just saying that there is a tendency to sort of not dive into the depth of what a musical theater performer can be.
Well, I mean, I did private school musical theater, which is probably better funded, and yet it was still, you know, 60 of us on stage, and they're like just trying to keep us herded in one area. Over here, okay, all right.
Well, that's why I wanted to like say my name, Tucker Chase and Trevor Fanning, because they were people from my youth who directed children's and teen theater and really invested in it and really believed in the child actors and explored interesting themes and like, you know, did readings of the Laramie Project and all this stuff. It was just, it was really different. It was a really different experience than when I went and did the summer teen musical in my town, which was also super fun and great, but it just wasn't, it wasn't that meaty, rich experience. And I think that's what gave me the like love to do this for the rest of my life and really drove me forward, because I saw what it could be at such a young age.
Yeah. But it sounds like you were both, you know, deeply invested from the very beginning in doing this. Nick, you went to school for theater as well. Is that correct? How did that, you mentioned earlier that you, they taught you well the difference between, you know, on stage theater and film. I'm going to be honest, I've talked to a lot of people who went to a lot of schools that didn't teach the distinction. Tell me more about the school that you went to, how it went.
I'm saying they taught it very badly. I think the education, the theater education for a long time, I don't think this is true, but for a long time in the UK, was very much, you know, designed for theatre and theatre roles, with the idea, I suppose, that theatre actors find roles on television and films, I mean, maybe to pay the bills or whatever it is, but with the idea, I guess, there's probably some sort of higher art form.
Well, to be fair, actors are treated like not like the scum of the earth in the UK. They're treated like theatre is an actual valid career path, I feel, which is not so much the case in the U.S. I think, like, okay, people want to be movie stars in the U.S., but the idea of theater as a valid career path for people, where they're not like, don't do theater, go get an education.
It's funny. It makes me think of what Nick said earlier about right before you're going to get on stage, that there's a part of your brain that second guesses this choice because the whole world is second guessing this choice all the time. People are always like, what do you mean? So what do you do? I'm like, I teach theater. And they're like, oh, like in a high school? I'm like, no, like around, like to people who, you know, at five or six different schools, like to whoever, if you want me, I'll go teach it to you right now. What do you want? Like, I'm not, you know, and they're like, I don't, what's that? How's that a career, right? And in fact, I almost appreciate that we're having this discussion, because this is kind of, in my mind, one of the reasons why I did this podcast. I taught people improv. I've been teaching improv for 10 years. And one of the biggest questions I get from people is, like, what do I do with this? Thanks for this information. It was great. But, like, where do I take this knowledge now? And so I was like, huh, where do you take this knowledge? And, like, me and my drama degree were like, yeah, what do you do? You know, and so I started interviewing people, starting with, you know, Austin-based improvisers, of course. But, you know, leading to what are other jobs that you can have? And I've just talked to lots of different people that do lots of different kinds of, you know, performance. I mean, like, even you guys, like, this is sustainable for you guys, is it not? I mean, this is what you guys are doing. You're touring with this. This is real. And well, to a certain extent, somehow could be considered, quote, more real than some of the other things. You know, some of the people I know are like, yeah, I have a Friday night show at this thing, but I don't get paid, or nobody knows who I am. And so people feel like there's this hierarchy. In my mind, there isn't. If you're doing it, no matter whether anyone knows you or whether it's on, you're famous or it's on television or someone can find it on YouTube, it's still awesome because you're doing it.
Oh, hell yeah.
You're
hell
doing
yeah.
it.
But I have to say, like, I'm glad we're talking about this too, because I think transparency is something that is really lacking in our industry, whatever that industry is, the entertainment industry. And
yeah, large.
It is not sustainable for our lives to do what we're doing right now. Like, we do not earn even most of our income or even half of our income doing, you know, theater, comedy.
There's pure investment of what we do. We're probably at a loss.
Yeah, but we're lucky that Nick has a good and flexible day job. He is a tutor. He teaches all of his clients online, so he can do it from wherever.
Awesome.
And for a long time, I was a nanny, and then I was a party princess, which was super fun, actually.
Is that like at Disney?
Not at Disney, no, but I would go around to little children's parties, and I would dress as every princess imaginable, including Ariel and the Finn and Shelbra, and I would sing songs and tell stories and twist balloon animals and paint faces, and it was amazing.
Aww.
But I was really good at fielding their difficult questions because of improv and because of all my acting. You know, if they would say, how can you look different than in the cartoon? And I would say things like, well, you know, when you draw a picture of something, it doesn't look quite the same, but it's kind of how your imagination sees it. And they'd be like, yeah, I'm like, it's just like that. They drew a cartoon of my life. Oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, so it was fun to be able to not ruin the magic for them. And now what I do is I narrate audiobooks. That's my day job. And it's a nice source of passive income. If anyone wants to listen to them, they're really good. Okay. They're called The Chronicles of Kerrigan by W.J. May. They're like young adult fantasy, and it's kind of a combination of Harry Potter and 007, but it's a kick-ass teenage girl as the lead, and I love doing them. So the thing is, you have to have this piecemeal existence for most of the time as a performer. It is only like the top 2 to 5% of people who don't have to worry about doing anything else but perform or write or whatever the case may be. So I think that's also really important to know. Success in this industry isn't measured by how much money you're making doing it. I think it's measured by the fact that you're doing something you care about, that you're reaching people, that you're having an impact. And yeah, we all want to make money doing this. We all want to not worry about the next paycheck, but it takes a while to get there. And not everybody does get there. Some people perform on the weekends or do community theater or whatever it is. And like you said, it's all valuable. It's all valid.
Yeah, it's just good that you're putting it out there in the same way that, like, you know, even the theater teachers in the you know, school districts that are strapped for cash that, like, are trying their best to make everybody care about Romeo and Juliet for the millionth time. Like, it matters. It matters that they're doing that because, you know, people need it. People need the stories. They need things to come out. And in fact, I wonder, since you guys are, let me connect the ideas because I was like, wait, I'm jumping too fast. I think we need stories to help us through the world as it is. The culture is changing so fast and there's so much that's going on in such a huge way. And I feel like there's a deluge of art and like theater and stuff that's coming out right now. And I feel like because of the internet, it's like relevant to the minute. You know what I mean? Like you get a video on your phone and you're all like, didn't this thing just happen 5 minutes ago? How are these three guys in full costume doing it already? Like, you know, it's a wild and insane kind of thing. And you guys are doing these videos once a week. Are you being affected by the world around you and communicating, you know, what's going on in the world through the comedy that you're writing?
Yeah, I think on a more meta level, I think for us, one of the reasons we wanted to start doing our own stuff is because we're frustrated actors and we wanted an opportunity to do the kind of work that we wanted to do. But also, we always wanted to create stuff that was positive and that was able to have a positive impact on the world. So first of all, we want to entertain people, but a lot of our comedy does have messaging in it. And a big focus for me specifically has been feminism. So there's been a lot of that. And we have, like, we wrote a sketch back in 2017, which was called Christmas Crime. And it was basically all about victim blaming. But instead of blaming a rape victim, it was blaming the victim of a robbery of her house. And it was really impactful. And it was really important for me at the time because I had just gone through something very publicly a couple of months prior to that. And I had not really been writing and I felt sort of frustrated by everything. And I realized that this was a good vehicle to sort of channel some of that energy into. And then in a less kind of serious way, we wrote a sketch before 4th of July in 2016, which was about Britain and America, and Britain and America were exes, and he shows up at her birthday party, and it's awkward, and we sort of made an allusion to Brexit without even saying Brexit, and it became the Brexit sketch. It got 2.5 million views in 4 days, and, you know, that's all anybody was talking about. So I think first and foremost, we write stuff that we're passionate about and that we think is funny and that has messages that we care about. But it does tap into sort of the zeitgeist and what's happening in culture because we're tapped into it and we care about it and we want to create things that are of value.
I think something you said there, which was about the power of story, and it's something we've become more and more aware of, which is that you know, we are in Hollywood. There have been a lot of issues in Hollywood, but they're only representative of issues that are generally extant in the world. The thing is that Hollywood tells the stories, and Hollywood is the one that starts to shape what we think. And Sarah particularly has been a huge advocate of telling fresh stories, which are more representative.
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying this in the press for almost 2 years now, is that, you know, we create culture. Advertising and entertainment are what create the culture that we live in, and we have the power to change that culture by the stories we tell. And I believe very, very passionately in that, and so does Nick. And so it's nice that we're able to, in our very small way, in our relatively small platform, sort of hopefully add to that. We are both white people who are straight, so the diversity is not great when we're just on screen together.
Yeah.
But at least we can try to tell stories that matter and that uplift voices that aren't always heard. And, you know, when we do cast actors outside of ourselves, we try to be as cognizant of being as diverse and welcoming as possible, because it's, you know, it's not good out there right now for a lot of people. And we aren't lawmakers, we aren't policymakers, so we can have the impact we have by the stories we tell.
And I think, I mean, Sarah, as we just said, Sarah cottoned onto this first, you know, and sort of informed our direction, and certainly made me more aware of it as time has gone on. But I think we've also realized that what sometimes seems quite frivolous, which is, you know, hey, we're performers, we're doing comedy, we're trying to make you laugh.
Look at us, ha ha.
You know, and it sometimes feels like it's maybe too egotistical or something like that, but it's realizing that comedy is a great way to engage people and for people to relax and sort of lower their walls, really, and then you can chat about things and as Sarah says, you can really start to shape the culture or affect the culture or make people rethink things that they may have taken for granted. And
we've been able to reach people that I don't think would have been reachable if it was more preachy or didn't have sort of the wrapping of comedy, because as Nick says, you know, if you laugh, your walls come down and you're more open to hearing things. And we do have fans who get angry about some of the stuff that we put out, but they don't disappear. They like stick it out and they enjoy the next thing. So that's also been nice too, is that we have a pretty broad audience and we're not ever trying to pander to any particular audience. We're just putting out what we believe in, and people typically respond positively. And there's always a couple of trolls who respond really negatively to the feminist stuff, but I knew that
always
was coming.
The
feminist stuff, yeah.
Oh.
Nick was very surprised by that the first time it happened.
He was very naively surprised, but I've learned.
Well, one of my other favorite quotes is, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I think that's also been reflected in a lot of what we've experienced, putting certain things out there too.
Yeah. I find as I get older, I realize just how difficult it is to see the world in any other way than your own way. So you have to be so, you have to be working so hard on a regular basis to see other points of views, to understand what's going on, like consuming as much as you can about cultures that, you know, you're not a part of, understanding history from every point of view. And it's really, I recently went to an independent film festival for women, and it was just amazing the like work these women were doing to like give voices to different groups. And I was like, this is great. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
And I never feel like you mentioned, you know, it's hard being a white person and trying to like tell people anything because it's like, yeah, I know, I'm sorry. And it's like, I just want to try to help. I think it's important that you guys are doing it through the satirical comedy that you're doing. And also, you know, based on the videos that I've seen, I think you guys are doing a really good job of framing it. You know, satire can come and really hit people harshly. Like we were talking about the negativity that you guys receive sometimes. I was going to say to that, you know, anger is an acceptable reaction. It's just what you do with that anger. Like it's totally fine. You can be angry all day. Like, but what are you going to do with that anger? How is it going to change you or the world around you? And if it's a negative impact, well, then that's not great. That's not great. But if it's a positive impact, you're like, oh, man, like even the idea that it's like, I didn't realize that people were so angry about feminism. Yeah, turns out they are. Makes them super mad. It's a real triggering word, that one. So what do you do for that? It's like, okay, like how do you make the word or the idea, the concept of feminism as silly as humanly possible? Like,
I had one sketch, which was called Diagnosis Misogyny. In which a man goes to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, you got back your tests and they all seem normal, but you do seem to have a bad case of misogyny. And then the doctor, then the patient's asking all sorts of questions and trying to understand this and then trying to correct the doctor and trying to explain what it really is and all these sorts of things. And what was very funny about the comments on that particular thread, because that one got a lot of comments. And there was a lot of discussions and mini arguments breaking out in the comments. What was very funny is that all the comments and always from men, actually not always from men.
No, not always from men. Misogyny is not just a male thing.
No. But all the comments which were anti the
message of the video.
Were illustrated within the video. And if I had the time and information, I think I would have given timestamps for every single in response to every single trolling comment.
Well, there were some people, who other fans, who were great, being like, oh, that's just like the characters on this sketch. I don't know. It's, I mean, a lot of me in the past couple of years has been fueled by anger. There's a lot that I'm angry about, and I have tried to turn it as much as possible into art and activism and art as activism. And I think that is something that's really productive. And that's the thing, too, is, like, I don't want my anger to create negativity. So the art we create is not, I think, for the most part, heavy. Or, you know, we'll never do a Trump sketch. Like, that's just not our style. So we might talk about ideas around what's going on in the administration and how that's sort of illustrated in larger terms or really small personal terms, but we won't, you know, Nick's not going to dress up as Donald Trump and I'm not going to dress up as Melania. It's just not what we do.
Can I tell you guys a funny story about somebody thinking a sketch was a Donald Trump sketch?
Yes, please.
So you're right that, you know, it can feel like a low blow both to use the character and to even like discuss like what's happening. It's like, this is a third beat to begin with. I can't, what am I supposed to do with it? Like, I actually told when I started writing, I was like, I was teaching a class like right when the election happened and I was like, we're in a third beat world now. Your third beats mean nothing. Make them crazier. But anyway, so I watch HBO Family with my baby. I have a 2-year-old and there was this kids version of The Emperor's New Clothes. Are you guys aware of that fairy tale?
Oh, yes.
Okay, great. And it's a very basic, it's a super short little, like, It was like 10 minutes long. It was like a little song about the king who's like, I'm the best. And then everyone's like, oh, no, he's naked. You know, very simple, very basic. Very basic, real cute. I liked it. And there were a few famous people that did voices. So I went to the IMDb of it just to kind of be like, oh, wait, whose voice is that? I was looking it up. And on the IMDb for this cartoon of HBO Family made of a, like, Hans Christian Andersen, like, hundreds of year old story, the one and only comment on the IMDb page is, this is some anti-Trump trash and I won't have it. And I was like, wow. You are such an idiot. This is not even, he's not, it was hundreds of years before Trump was even a glimmer in anyone's eye. Like, what?
Isn't that so telling, though?
So telling.
Because that reveals that that person who clearly supports Trump sees Trump's behaviors in this character.
Oh, good point.
I think that is fascinating.
I know. It really was like, I was like, whoa. I really wanted to respond and be like, this says more about what you think about Trump than what anybody thinks about Trump. You see he's naked. You see he's naked.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow. Oh, man. It was just so like, wow. And it made me think of, you know, you guys saying the comments were like answered in the video. I was all like, dude. Your comment like just makes the whole experience of me watching this child cartoon so much better.
Yeah. The first thing we ever did that went viral was a series called Feminist Fairy Tales. And in it, I play a little girl who's retelling fairy tales in like 2 minutes. And I highlight the misogynistic elements of it without even realizing that's what I'm doing, basically. And they're all based on, like, the Disney versions of the fairy tales. And people are like, oh, she hates Disney, blah, blah. I am literally sitting right now talking to you in Disneyland. I love Disney so much. I love all the princesses. I always have. I was party princess, whatever. The point is, what I was trying to highlight is that nothing is perfect, and we are inundated with this dangerous messaging from a really young age. So, like, while the stories might be great and could be empowering, there are these little tiny threads that are so subtle of misogyny sort of going throughout all of them, and they poison us. And what was encouraging is as I went through the catalog, the more modern the movies got, the Disney movies got, the harder it was to find the misogynistic subplot. So I was like, I don't hate Disney. I love Disney. Disney was doing storytelling that was reflective of the time that they were telling stories in and the culture that they were telling stories in, and they're getting better. And that, I think, is hopeful. And I think that's something positive that we can focus on. And it's like, you can be critical of something and not hate it. And I think people forget that.
Not to mention, like, let's be honest, like, all the old school Disney things, they didn't write the stories. They were public domain.
Oh. Right.
They, like, took the stories from folklore and then told them. They didn't invent it. Like,
no.
It's not their fault the mother has to die at the beginning of every single fairy tale.
And they made them less bad. In the actual Sleeping Beauty, she basically gets raped in her sleep by the man who comes to, quote-unquote, rescue her, and giving birth wakes her up.
Super good times.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Awful, but
yeah.
That was the original version of the story.
But she's been blessed with a child.
I know.
Going to the 19th century.
So look, we're pushing back against eons of this crap, and it's hard to overcome. But we can do it with storytelling.
Yeah, one thing that's been very interesting, I think, actually doing this in comedy is it takes quite a lot of inventiveness to be, as it were, on the right side of a situation and be comedic, because, of course, comedy thrives on, you know, breaking expectations and going against the grain and so forth. And so finding a way to be, you know, it's very easy to come up with ideas, I think, which, you know, do punch down or do...
Not for me.
I mean...
I don't know.
The thing is, it's not... I don't mean, like, being, like, nuts. I mean, I define it as being nasty in that respect. But, you know, it's to make the... make it... I don't know, how do I put this? That it doesn't come out, that, as it were, the... You're not punching down, that you're actually really making sure that everybody is, the message coming out of it is a good, wholesome one as opposed to a mean one.
Yeah, well, I found that really interesting.
Mean comedy.
It can be. I think, so our process as writers was that Nick was writing long before I was and always saw himself as a writer, and I didn't really see myself as a writer. And we created this web series together where I did a lot of, like, massaging of the dialogue and helping develop the characters, but Nick was doing a lot of the heavy lifting on actually, like, writing and the structure and stuff. And we look back now at some of that writing, and I'm really frustrated because I don't think I had fully come into my confidence at that point. And there are jokes or there are subplots or whatever that don't feel like they're on the right side of the line to me. And so it's frustrating, and we can edit around it, and we can, you know, fix it in the pilot version of it. But while it's frustrating, it's also encouraging to see that both of us have come a long way in terms of that. And, you know, recognizing internalized misogyny or implicit biases or where our blind spots are. And I think that's the thing, too, is, like, we're always doing better, at least we're attempting to do better. And I think people should be reminded of that. It's like, I don't know, I think people accuse me a lot of the time of expecting everyone to be perfect. And if they're not perfect, they should never have a career again, blah, 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 whatever. That's not what it is. I think people need to own up to what they've done if they've done something wrong. They need to continue to develop and grow and make better choices and tell better stories. And some people just, it's like a taste thing. It's like, all right, you wrote some shitty jokes 10 years ago and now you're not anymore. Cool. You've grown. Great. We can get on board with that. And some people have done something really terrible. And in order for them to progress and have a career again, they need to actually engage in restorative justice. And I think people don't understand that element of it. And I want people to get on board with that more, is like, perfection isn't the aim, but doing better is the aim and owning your shit is the aim. And so hopefully we do that. If we ever, you know, if we ever get on the wrong side of something, I want to just be able to own it and learn from it and do better for ourselves and for the community that we might have, you know, insulted, or for our audience, or whatever it is, because nobody's perfect. And when you're trying to do comedy, I think you do sometimes end up on the wrong line, the side of a joke. It happens.
Well, I hope that we can be as forgiving. And right now, the culture is not so forgiving, well, with doxing and all that. But, you know, I hope that we can be as forgiving to ourselves as, you know, you were to Disney a moment ago, where it's like, you know, you give them the credit for, like, yeah, it was 1955, man. Like, how woke is he need to be for you to like him? Like, but in the same way that, like, literally, I can't watch How I Met Your Mother anymore. I love that show. I love that show so much. It's the only show up for years that I've watched week to week. I love it so much. I can't watch it. Like, as soon as my brain was, like, told, like, hey, did you know you should watch out for this? I was like, what? And I feel like it happened to so many people where it's like, I can't unsee it. I can't stop. I love Neil Patrick Harris, and I would give him my child. But
I love him.
His character on the show is disgusting, and I can't watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. I totally get that. And I think you said something like, let's be forgiving, right? And it was 1955. I think that's true, but I also think there's a limit to that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, definitely.
1955, so we're all telling stories. Like, you can't be like, well, yeah, he raped her, but it was 1955. That was just the time and the place. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, I meant, like, artistically.
Yeah, artistically. And I think the thing is, now we are having these conversations in public.
Yeah.
And go back to the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement, and those people were forcing these conversations and forcing these changes for the betterment of everybody, and they were getting shot down and physically harmed and killed. And it's like, it is a fight. It is a long, long fight to make changes, whatever those changes are, from a cultural and a societal place. And I hope now we're in a place where these changes will happen and things will move forward. But you're seeing pushback. You're seeing huge pushback.
You know what's occurring to me as we're talking is this thing of changing hearts and minds, right? There's that whole thing. It's the changing hearts thing that's occurring to me. And the thing about telling stories and getting across to people and raised with our emotive, obviously, actually really sort of changes your soul as opposed to your intellect, if you know what I mean? Because I'm reminded of, you know, the thing people sometimes say, I don't know, I said it not that long ago, something along the lines of, you know, can we say this anymore? And it's more like, what are the rules?
Yeah.
As opposed to, why would you even want to say this?
Yeah.
So I often give an example, actually. This is, honestly, I give this example of teaching math to my pupils when I'm talking about the difference between rules and just pure comprehension of the facts. But it's true here as well, which is that if you think about something like the Ten Commandments and the commandment, thou shalt not steal, you don't want to have the situation where people only don't steal because they're going, oh, hang on, wait, that rule. Do you remember that rule? What's that rule? Oh, yeah, the one you don't steal. You want people to wake up in the morning knowing full well they're not going to steal, because why would you want to steal? You don't need the commandment because it's so clearly true.
Yeah.
And I think that's, we're kind of on that transition where we may have reached minds. We actually have to get people's hearts to go, oh, actually, yeah, I don't want to be like that.
Yeah, I think there's two things. It's like people are either going to do something or not do something for two reasons. One, because of the impact it's going to have on them. Or two, because they realize the human impact it's going to have on another human being. And I think that if you can't make them understand how it's going to impact them, you have to get to them somehow and get to their heart and get them to realize that it's hurting other people or it's helping other people or whatever the case may be. Because we all walk around with this sense of fear, I think. And I think fear is what keeps people separate, and fear is what keeps people fighting each other, and fear is what keeps people hating each other. And so if we can reach a point of understanding and empathy, then I think that's how we really reach people. And it's going to sound really worthy and like we're patting ourselves on the back, but I think comedy can help do that. I think performance can help do that. I think art and writing and creativity can help do that in a way that a news story might not, or an article might not. I mean, if it's really well crafted, it can. But, you know, it's story. It's humanity. It's just connecting to that human piece.
When you guys write, do you ever think about connecting to the people that disagree with you, like in a way that like with some of the things that you're writing, you know, are you trying to find a way to reach, you know, hearts and minds of the people that disagree with you and try to convince them in a different way?
Yeah, I think for me, like the Christmas crime thing was very much that.
Awesome.
It was taking the idea of victim blaming, you know, blaming victims of sexual violence, which is a very heated topic and makes people want to pull away from it or fight against it or go, oh, you stupid feminazis, whatever they want to say. And instead take the ideas and the concepts and the emotional consequences of that and put it onto a different crime so that it is more palatable to people who would normally put up their wall.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the thing, like preaching to the choir is all well and good, but it's not really going to change anything.
Mm.
So I think you have to find ways around that. You have to find ways in. And we also do a lot of history comedy. And I think this wasn't like designed. We're both history nerds, so that's why we wanted to do history comedy. But I think doing the history comedy is actually an interesting way in to people who might be more conservative or see themselves as patriots or whatever. Because look, I love America. I consider myself a patriot. I love history. I think it's flawed and complicated, but I'm really invested in it. So I think we opened up our audience to, or we opened up our material to a different audience because we were doing this stuff about history, and because people who had an appreciation for history sometimes also might be on the more conservative end of things. And so they've been exposed to things through our comedy that maybe they would have been more resistant to if it was coming from a different source. So we don't want to be polarizing in what we create, but we also won't like temper our message so we don't polarize people, but we want to be open to people. We want people of all sort of walks of life to be able to enjoy what we do and hopefully get something more than just a laugh out of it.
Yeah, I think we're very consciously trying to make it so that people can all gather, I think, in under, you know, I think so what I'm trying to say is I think somebody else made the point that art is something that we can all experience together, and it can be a very healing and inclusive and a very healing and inclusive place where the people from all sides of the spectrum of all sides of different spectrums can be experiencing the same thing and feel emotion and feel connection with their fellow human beings, which is a very powerful thing and a very important thing. There's a contrast to the separation and the fear that Sarah mentioned. So I think we're consciously attempting to do that while at the same time not stifle ourselves, which
exactly
can be quite a tricky thing, I suppose, at times.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. You know, we're artists. We are seeking, you know, connecting with the audience. But, you know, it can be tough when you have a lesson in your hand. You know, I don't know about you guys, but when I was a kid, I was, you know, overtaken by the after school special. All of the after school specials that they played that were very didactic. Also, I'm realizing I'm from Boston. And I think this was only at commercials in the area, but there was a church, the Latter-day Saints, that were putting on commercials that were like life lessons as well. Like it'd be like, you know, a kid would go to take a lie or tell a lie. And then like a bunch of people with like webs would show up and they'd talk about how like you weave a web of lies. And I was like, wow. Like a dance number to convince this kid not to lie.
A vague memory of that. I grew up in Connecticut, so I'm wondering if I might have also gotten those.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing is, like, look, it's not like every time we sit down to write, we're like, let's write a message.
We write stupid stuff about
spies who gossip a lot or, you know, whatever.
Or a mobster trying to get a mortgage.
Yeah, so a lot of it is very silly.
Oh, you're doing it every week, of course. Jeez. Yeah. Can't all be saving the world.
Sometimes it's just little things, like maybe flipping who plays what character based on gender and what people would expect, or you know, just being aware of the world that we're in and the impact we have. So making the choices we can to make sure that we're not adding to any of the negativity that's in the world.
Yeah, that's very true. I think it's sort of to your point, it has to be entertainment first, and any messaging or whatever needs to be a very subtle undercurrent, because it's something didactic and it's pretty surefire way to make people turn off.
So we're getting close to the end. I want to ask you guys one more question before we say goodbye. You have been traveling and touring. Have there been any fun road stories or any wild happenings while you were in a different country or, you know, working, doing a festival that maybe didn't speak your language? Anything interesting happen along the way?
Well, let's see. We've done some shows in Paris. And it was, I mean, I think the audience was, they were generally English speakers, but we opened the show by speaking French, and I think they got excited, and then we switched back into English. I don't know, it's been really interesting touring around both the United States and around the world, because different audiences respond so differently to our material, and especially with the history stuff, like, we never know how it's going to hit in foreign countries, but it always goes down really well.
I'm curious when we performed in Canada because there's that sense of like how much is this history going to overlap, but also because Canada is kind of the British side of the American experience, muddled in with French.
Yeah, we were in Toronto and I think it was the most appreciative audience of our history and like geopolitical stuff that we've ever had. Apparently, like, I think the Canadians are more well-educated on American history than Americans are. That's the impression I got.
Probably.
Or that particular audience. Yeah. I don't know. It's kind of a crazy whirlwind. Like, I remember last summer in Europe, we were touring our show, and then we also shot a short film. And
we did a performance outside the Netherlands in someone's.
Oh yeah, we did a living room show in the Netherlands, which was arranged by a fan of ours who we had never met, who has now become a dear friend.
Oh my God,
that was super
cool. And
then
she showed us around the windmill neighborhood.
And then we got stuck in the Netherlands trying to fly back to England the day before we were filming this short film. We got delayed. We didn't know we were going to get back. We got back, and I decided that was when I was going to share my story about Harvey Weinstein. And so, literally, the last day before we were filming, we were trying to prep everything. I was like giving my interview to Variety, doing a live BBC radio show. The next day, we started filming. Between takes, I was fielding calls from like every international news source ever. And I just said the other day, like, thank God I had that film at the time to do, because I would have been completely drowning in, like, the craziness and anxiety of sharing this extremely personal, difficult thing with the world.
Thank God you were out of the country.
Oh my God, it was insane. Maybe it would have been easier if I was in the country. I don't know. I was like on the phone at all hours of the day. But I think our art and our touring and our filming is so intertwined with our life that it just feels like one big mishmash of like life and vacation and touring our show and filming a sketch and trying to see our parents. And we're very bad at work-life balance, like incredibly bad at it. Again, to that point, we're in Disneyland right now and we're doing this podcast because we care about our art and we like to talk to people about it, and we're okay to take a break from our quote-unquote vacation to do a little work and stay focused and, you know.
All right, what ride did you go on right before we talked on the phone?
Literally right before we were on Guardians of the Galaxy for the first time. And it was incredibly fun.
We were in line, and I was saying to Sarah, I think we might have to leave the line because we won't get through
this. And I was like, nah, trust me, I know how these lines work. And sure enough, perfect timing.
Just in time.
I was kind of afraid I wouldn't have a voice for the podcast because I was screaming so much on the ride.
It was
super fun.
I'm glad it's all good, but, like, it would have been hilarious. You're like, hey, by the way, just got off a roller coaster, doing this sort of emotional roller coaster discussion. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Exactly. So funny.
We have a very strange life.
Oh, super
really
weird.
Do.
Incredibly weird. But I don't think we'd have it any other way. At our wedding, Nick said that one lifetime with me was like 9 lifetimes with someone else. And that was right at the very beginning. You didn't even know what you were getting yourself into then.
No, I really underestimated.
She's a Highlander. She's never going away. Like, it's going to be crazy.
That would
make sense. People are very confused that my face hasn't aged since I was 18. So maybe I'm not a vampire. Maybe I'm a Highlander. Maybe that's what it is.
It is.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Across the ages, and everyone else has grown up around her. She is safe, frozen in time. Very cute.
Well, and Nick is older than me and also went prematurely gray, so he always says that he ages like a normal person and I don't. So as the years go by, he just looks creepier and creepier being married to me. So,
sorry, Nick. That's so true. It's so true that it's I don't know. Because I don't think of myself as being old. And
you're not old.
There you go. You see? That's why I don't think of myself as being old. Why would you say that? Why would you say that? I'm not. Yeah.
You're very young-looking person I'm speaking on the phone with.
Uh-huh. My voice is extremely young. Wait,
so young. Who's this baby I'm talking to?
He's very eloquent. Yeah, he's not
at all. It's amazing. Guys, British toddlers are so smart. It's amazing.
That's, I rely on people thinking that. I think it's like what you were saying earlier on about Brits having this. Oh no, you were saying, Sarah was saying about Brits having this, this, you know, actually kind of
appreciation
of actors. I think America has an appreciation of British actors. I think that's what it really is.
Oh, mm-hmm. when we first moved to LA, we met with this casting director, and they're like, you're going to do great because you're from New York and he trained in New York and he's from England and he trained in England. So it's like already the industry looks at New York actors as like real actors. And then you find an English actor and you're like, oh, it's like you're descended from Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you come from New York, then somehow that means that you're that you value your craft and that you've really taken time to study everything. If you come from England, it's just in your life. That seems to be the impression on the West Coast, and it's like, oh, thank you very much. You only seen that at this point. Casting director, we've only just met, but you somehow already seem to think that we are.
She's like, I already know you're good. Like, I mean, you're not wrong,
Let's go with that. Let's go with that. So
you're like, watch another video, just one more. Just please, give me a real opinion. Tell me I'm kind of all right. Tell me. Oh man, it's so hard when they make you feel like they're blowing smoke. You're like, could you do the acting now and be like, oh, I found a gem from nowhere, like, I don't know.
Yeah, or like just kind of insult me a little bit so I
yeah.
know that
I just came from New York. This is how we speak with love. Yeah, it's funny how that is. Like, I lived in New York for 5 years, and the work that I did in there, which is probably the least important work that I did in my whole life, people are always like, oh, well, that's amazing. And I'm like, really? Really? That's the thing you love? You think that's super great? I've done 150 shows since then, but that's great. Okay.
Well, when you're smart, cool. You move to Austin, which has, like, good weather, just like we moved to L.A., which has good weather, and I think that's a huge part of being happy.
Well, it's not just that. This town has so much theater, like, that we were talking earlier about, like, live theater versus film. There's, like, a tiny touch of film, tiniest little touch, more a few years ago, but there have been tax changes, so not so much anymore, but a ton, so much live theater. So for me, that being my bread and butter, I love it. I think it's great. I will never tire. I will never take all the classes there are to take. I will never act in every theater there is to act in. There are just so many places to go that it's great. So no matter what sort of like change I decide, like it's like, now I'm going to do this. I can do it. It's just here and I need to find the new group. So yeah, Austin's pretty great.
I associate Austin with just being permanently having a festival.
Yeah.
So if it's,
oh, yeah.
If it's one festival, you go straight into the next festival. I imagine there are more festival days than non-festival days than Austin.
It's true. We call March through August festival season.
Wow.
Yeah.
Happy.
Festival of festivals.
Every single weekend, there's a different, everybody's celebrating of absolutely everything that happens in this town. Yeah, and the street closures, oh my God. I tell you what, January 1st, the scramble for permits is insane.
Really?
It's crazy. Yeah, because the bigger festivals buy them up early, and then the later festivals don't realize, and then they're like, oh no, we can only have 6 food vendors on the street because, you know, they bought 150 for this other one, and, you know, whatever. Because there's just so much. It's like I walk down the, I go downtown. That's where my main theater is. My main theater is Fallout Theater. If you ever come to town, please come to Fallout Theater. And we're right downtown. And so I'll be going to like rehearsal, and I'm like, why is the whole street, you know, closed off? And they're like, oh, it's the, you know, motorcycles made in the Southern California Festival, and you're like, oh, okay. Or it's it's olives from Italy Festival. Oh, cool. Books written by Asian American gay men. Oh, okay. Super specific.
I'm pretty sure last time we were there, there was a beard festival happening, like a beard grooming.
Oh, you're right, there was.
Festival.
There was.
Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of very creative beards.
Some amazing beards.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes a lot of sense. That seems very likely.
Sounds like Austin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Austin's the only town you can have a tattoo on your face and be a successful CEO of a company.
That is not too shabby. I'm
kind of
into that.
That's the new slogan for Austin.
I'm so into that. All right, now I just want Taco Deli. Oh my God. Why am I not in Austin right now?
Oh, you guys are funny.
I love
There's lots of tacos, so many of them. They're all available for you anytime you come by, and which I'm sure will be sooner than later, because, hey, we're chock right in the middle of festival season right now.
Some festival for us to come to.
Guys. I'm surprised you're not in my living room right now.
British American husband wife comedy duo festival.
Is that where we fight all the other British American husband wife comedy duos?
That's exactly what it is.
I get that.
I think if you just did a husband-wife comedy duo festival in this town alone, there'd probably be at least 12 shows.
I think you're right.
I think
we've met a couple.
There's a lot.
Let's do it.
There's a lot.
Let's arrange it.
Husband-wife comedy festival.
That would actually be hilarious.
Well, maybe like a spouses comedy festival. We don't want to be excluding anybody here.
You're totally right. You're totally right. Since we're definitely making this festival, we should make sure that we include everyone.
Mm-hmm.
This seems like a good idea.
Okay, you heard it here first, y'all.
I always do these kinds of things, like in the interviews, and I'll listen to them later, and I was like, oh, that's a great idea. We are never doing that idea. There's so many great ideas on this podcast. Please, audience, steal them, every one of them. Write the sketch, make the festival, do all of it, because the rest of us are busy. So you guys need to do this. Get to
and
it. So fun.
Invite us to perform.
Oh, yeah.
I know. We'll love to do it. So great. Imagine you get a phone call. Hi, guys. You're the headliners for the first Spouse Festival.
I'd die. I'd love it.
Oh, my goodness.
So great. Well, thank you guys so much for swinging into, you know, the nearest closet in Disneyland to chat with me for an hour. I hope that you don't get in trouble with security and or any of the Disney princesses. I hope they're not like, hey, you've been in the bathroom for 2 hours. Why?
Run.
I'm just saying, if you go to Disney jail, that's your next video. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, thank you for having us on. It has been a delight.
Good. Thank you so much for sharing everything. And I feel like we've had such a great conversation, you know, about having this as a career, what you can do, the efforts, you know, that you can make to change the world, and, you know, even the ups and downs of, you know, how much this career can take from you. Can you make all your money with it? Do you really have to for it to be complete and in your heart? These are the great things that we got to talk about, and I'm so glad that I got to share them with you. Thank you so much to the wonderful sketch troupe. We are Tomathy. Thank you so much. Did I pronounce that right?
Thank you. Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
It was on bated breath, and you got it right.
Thank you.
I did my research to make sure that I did it right. So thanks, guys. Have a wonderful time. Enjoy the next roller coaster.
Oh, we will.
Oh, we will. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.